This is a part F, the spiritual or cultural sciences, chapter 17 of Rudolf Steiner's book, A Theory of Knowledge Implicit in Goethe's World Conception. Chapter 17 is entitled Introduction, Spirit, and Nature. We have exhausted the realm of the knowledge of nature. Organics is the highest form of natural science. What lies still higher is the spiritual or cultural sciences. These require an essentially different attitude of the human mind toward objects from that characterizing the natural sciences. In the latter, the mind has a universal role to play. Its task is, so to speak, to bring the world process itself to a conclusion. What existed without the mind was only one half of reality. It was incomplete, at every point only a fragment. There, the mind has to call forth into phenomenal existence the innermost impelling forces of reality, even though these would have possessed validity without its subjective intervention. If man were a mere sense being, without mental conception, inorganic nature would be, nonetheless, dependent upon natural laws. But these would never come, as such, into manifest existence. Beings would certainly exist who would perceive the product, the sense world, but they would never perceive the producing, the inner conformity to law. It is really the genuine and indeed the truest form of nature which comes to manifestation in the human mind. Whereas, for a mere sense being, only nature's external aspect would exist. Knowledge plays here a role of world significance. It is the conclusion of the work of creation. What takes place in human consciousness is the interpretation of nature to itself. Thought is the last member in the series of processes whereby nature is formed. Not so is it in the case of cultural science. Here our consciousness has to do with spiritual content itself, with the individual human spirit, with the creations of culture, of literature, with the successive scientific convictions, with the creations of art. The spiritual is grasped by the spirit. Reality possesses here in itself the ideal, conformity to law, which elsewhere appears first in mental conception. What appears in the natural sciences only as a product of reflection about the object is here born in the object. Knowledge plays a different role. Essential being would be present in the objects here without the work of knowledge. It is human actions, creations, ideas with which we have to do. It is an interpretation of the human being to himself and to his race. Knowledge has here a different mission to discharge from that in connection with nature. Here again this mission first becomes manifest as a human need. Just as the necessity of finding in connection with the reality of nature, the idea of nature appears at first as a need of our minds, so here also the function of cultural science exists first as a human impulse. Again, it is only an objective fact, announcing itself as a subjective need. The human being should not, like a being of inorganic nature, act upon another being according to external norms, according to law which dominates him. Nor should he be the single form of a general type. But he should himself fix the purpose, the goal of his existence, of his activity. If his actions are the results of laws, these laws must be such as he gives to himself. What he is in himself, what he is among his own kind, in state and in history, this he must not be by reason of external determinations. He must be this of himself. How he fits himself into the texture of the world depends upon himself. He must find the point at which to participate in the mechanism of the world. It is here that the cultural sciences receive their function. Man must know the spiritual world in order to take his share in that world according to this knowledge. Here originates the mission which psychology, the science of peoples, footnote, Volkskunde, end footnote, and the science of history have to achieve. This is the essence of nature, that law and activity fall apart from each other, and activity seems to be controlled by law. But this, on the contrary, is the essence of freedom, that the two coincide, that the producing shall exist immediately in the product, and that the product shall be master of itself. Therefore the cultural sciences are in the highest degree sciences of freedom. The idea of freedom must be their central point, their dominant idea. It is for this reason that Schiller's Letters on Aesthetics take such high rank, because they undertake to find the nature of beauty in the idea of freedom, because freedom is the principle which permeates them. The spirit takes only that place in the universal, in the totality of the world, which it gives to itself as an individual, while the universal, the type idea, must be kept constantly in mind in organics. The idea of personality is to be held fast in the spiritual sciences. Not the idea as it lives in the general, the type, but as it appears in the single being, the individual, is here the matter in question. Naturally, it is not the casual personality, not this or that personality which is determinative, but personality as such. Not, however, as this evolves from itself outward into specialized forms and so comes first to sensible existence, but sufficient in itself, within itself circumscribed, finding in itself its destiny. The destiny of the type is to find itself realized in the individual. The destiny of the person is to achieve, even as an ideal entity, actual self-sustaining existence. When we speak of humanity in general, and when we speak of the general natural law, these are two quite different things. In the latter case, the particular is determined by the general. In the idea of humanity, the general is determined by the particular. If we are able to discern general laws of history, these are such only in so far as they were set up by historical personalities as goals or ideals. This is the inner contrast between nature and spirit. The former requires a knowledge which ascends from the immediately given, as the conditioned. To that, let me read this again. The former, that is nature, requires a knowledge which ascends from the immediately given, as the conditioned, to that which can be grasped by the mind, to the conditioning. The latter, spirit, requires such a knowledge as proceeds from the given, as the conditioning to the conditioned. That the particular establishes the law is characteristic of the spiritual sciences. That this role belongs to the general characterizes the natural sciences. That which is valuable to us in the natural sciences only as a transitional point, the particular, is our sole interest in the spiritual sciences. That which we seek in the former case, the general, is in the latter considered only to the extent that it interprets to us the particular. It would be contrary to the spirit of science if in the presence of nature we should limit ourselves to the particular. But it would be utterly fatal to the spirit if we should comprehend Greek history, for example, in a general scheme of concepts. In the former case, the senses, cleaving to the phenomenal, would achieve no science. In the latter, the mind, proceeding according to a general pattern, would lose all sense for the individual. Chapter 18. Psychological Cognition. The first science in which the human spirit deals with itself is psychology. The mind here stands observing itself. Fichte assigned an existence to man only to the extent that man ascribes this to himself. In other words, human personality has only those traits, characteristics, capacities, which it ascribes to itself through insight into its own being. A human capacity of which a man knew nothing would not be recognized by him as his own, but would be attributed to some one alien to him. When Fichte supposed that he could base the whole knowledge of the universe on this truth, he was in error. It is ordained to be the highest principle of psychology. It determines the method of psychology. If the human spirit possesses a characteristic, only in so far as it attributes this to itself, then the psychological method consists in the immersion of the mind in its own activity. Here, then, self-apprehension is the method. It is obvious that in this discussion we do not restrict psychology to being the science of the fortuitous characteristics of any one human individual, this one or that one. We realize the single mind from its fortuitous limitations, from its accessory traits, and seek to raise ourselves to a consideration of the human individual in general. Indeed, what is determinative is not that we consider the wholly fortuitous individual, but that we clarify our minds as to the self-determining individual in general. Whoever should say at this point that we should in that case be dealing with nothing more than the type of humanity confuses the type with the generalized concept. It is essential to the type that it as the general confronts its single forms. Not so with the concept of the human individual. Here the general is active immediately in the individual being, except that this activity expresses itself in various ways according to the object toward which it is directed. The type exists in single forms, and in these comes into reciprocal activity with the external world. The human spirit has only one form, but in one case certain objects move his feelings. In another, this ideal inspires him to actions, etc. It is not a specialized form of the human spirit. It is always the entire and complete man with whom we have to deal. He must be realized from his surroundings if he is to be comprehended. If we wish to arrive at the type, we must ascend from the single form to the primal form. If we wish to arrive at the human spirit, we must ignore the expressions in which it manifests itself, the special acts which it performs, and observe it in and of itself. We must discover how it behaves in general, not how it has behaved in this or that situation. In the case of the type, we must separate the universal form by comparison from the single forms. In psychology, we must separate the single forms only from their surroundings. Here the case is no longer the same as in organics. That, in the particular being, we recognize the molding of the primal form. But here, in perceiving the single forms, we recognize the primal form itself. The spiritual being of man is not one formation of its idea, but the formation thereof. When Jacobi believes that in becoming aware of our inner entity, we at the same time attain to the conviction that a unitary being lies at the basis of this entity, intuitive self-apprehension, his thought is in error, because we really become aware of this unitary being itself. What is otherwise intuition becomes here self-contemplation. In regard to the highest form of being, this is also an objective necessity. What the human spirit can read out of the phenomena is the highest form of content which it can attain at all. If the spirit then reflects upon itself, it must recognize itself as the direct manifestation of this highest, as indeed its very bearer. What the spirit finds as unity in multiform reality, this it must find in its own singleness as immediate existence. What it contrasts with particularization as the general, this it must attribute to its own individuality as its very nature. From all this it becomes clear that a true psychology can be attained only when we enter into the character of the human spirit in its activity. Nowadays, in place of this method, the effort has been made to set up another in which the subject matter of psychology has been not the human spirit itself, but the phenomena in which the spirit expresses its existence. It is supposed that the external expressions of the mind can be brought into an external interrelationship, as can be done with the facts of inorganic nature. In this way, the effort is made to found a, quote, theory of the soul without any soul, unquote. From our reflections, it becomes evident that by such a method, we lose sight of the very thing that is important. What ought to be done is to separate the human spirit from its manifestations and return to the spirit itself as the producer of these. Psychologists restrict themselves to the former and lose sight of the latter. Just here they have allowed themselves to be brought to the false standpoint which would apply to all sciences, the methods of mechanics, physics, etc. The unitary soul is given to us in experience, just as are its single actions. Every man is conscious of the fact that his thinking, feeling, and willing proceed from his ego. Every activity of our personality is bound up with this center of our being. If, in the case of any action, we ignore this union with the personality, it ceases to be a manifestation of the soul. It belongs under the concept either of inorganic or of organic nature. If two balls lie on the table and I thrust one against another, all that happens is resolved into physical or physiological occurrence, if my purpose and will are ignored. In all manifestations of the human spirit, thinking, feeling, willing, the important thing is to recognize these in their essential nature as expressions of the personality. It is upon this that psychology rests. But man does not belong to himself alone. He belongs also to society. What manifests itself in him is not merely his own individuality, but at the same time that of the folk group to which he belongs. What he performs proceeds from the folk force of his people, as well as from his own force. In his mission, he fulfills a part of that of his folk kindred. The important thing is that his place among his people shall be such that he may bring to complete effectiveness the power of his individuality. This is possible only when the folk organism is of such sort that the single person can find the place where he may plant his lever. It must not be left to chance whether or not he shall find this place. The way to inquire how the individual lives within the social group of his people is a matter for the science of peoples and the science of the state. The folk individuality is the subject of this science. It has to show what form the organism of the state must assume if the folk individuality is to come to expression within it. The constitution which a people gives to itself must be evolved out of its innermost nature. Here also there are certain fallacies of no small importance. The science of the state is held not to be an experiential science. It is held that the constitution of every people can be determined according to a certain stereotyped pattern. But the constitution of a people is nothing else than its individual character, brought into well-determined forms of law. Whoever would indicate beforehand the direction in which a definite activity of a people has to move must not impose upon this anything from without. He must simply express what lies unconscious in the character of the people. Quote, "It is not the intelligent person who controls, but intelligence, not the rational person, but reason," unquote, says Goethe. To grasp the folk individuality as rational is the method in the science of the peoples. Man belongs to a whole whose nature consists in the organization of the reason. Here also we may cite a significant word of Goethe's, quote, "The rational world is to be conceived as a great immortal individuality which unceasingly brings to pass what is necessary and thus makes itself master over the fortuitous," unquote. As psychology investigates the nature of the individual, so the science of the peoples must investigate that, quote, "immortal individuality," unquote. Chapter 19. Human Freedom. Our view as to the sources of our knowledge cannot be without influence upon our view in regard to practical conduct. Man behaves according to thought characterizations which lie within him. What he performs is directed according to purposes, goals, which he sets up for himself. But it is obvious that these goals, purposes, ideals, etc. will bear the same character as the rest of man's thought world. Thus a dogmatic science must result in a practical truth essentially unlike that which follows from our theory of knowledge. If the truths to which a person attains in knowledge are determined by objective necessity residing outside of thought, such also will be the ideals which he sets up as the bases of his conduct. In that case, a person behaves according to laws in whose establishment he has no part in any real sense. He thinks a norm for himself, which is foreordained for his behavior from without. But this is the character of a commandment which man has to obey. Dogma, as a practical truth, is moral commandment. The case is entirely different when the theory of knowledge here presented is made basic. This recognizes no other basis for truths than the thought content residing within these. When therefore a moral ideal comes into existence, it is the inner power lying in its content which governs our conduct. It is not because an ideal is given to us as a law that we conduct ourselves according to it, but because the ideal, by virtue of its content, is active within us, directs us. The impulse toward conduct lies not within us, without us, but within us. If we felt ourselves subjected to the commandment of duty, we should be compelled to behave in a definite manner, because it was so ordered. Here shall comes first, and afterward will, which must unite itself to the former. Let me read that again. Here, and then the word shall, in italics, comes first, and afterward, in italics, will, which must unite itself to the former. This is not true, according to our point of view. The will is sovereign. It performs only what lies as thought content in the human personality. Man does not receive thoughts from an external power. He is his own lawgiver. Who, indeed, according to our worldview, should give these to him? The world fundament has poured itself out completely into the world. It has not drawn back from the world in order to control it from without, but impels it from within. It has not withheld itself from the world. The highest form in which it emerges within the reality of ordinary life is that of thought, and with this human personality. If then the world fundament has goals, these are identical with the goals which man sets up for himself as he manifests his own being. Man is not behaving in accordance with the purposes of the guiding power of the world when he investigates one or another of his commandments, but when he behaves in accordance with his own insight. For in him the guiding power of the world manifests himself. He does not live as will somewhere outside of man. He has renounced his own will in order that all might depend upon the will of man. If man is to be enabled to become his own lawgiver, all thought about world determinations outside of man must be abandoned. We take this opportunity to call attention to the very excellent treatment of the subject by Kreienbühl in Philosophische Monatschriften, Volume 18, Number 3. This paper correctly explains how the maxims of our conduct result directly from the determination of our individuality, how everything which is ethically great is not given through the power of the moral law, but is performed on the basis of the direct impulse of an individual idea. Only from such a point of view is a true human freedom possible. If man does not bear within himself the reason for his conduct, but must guide himself in accordance with commandments, he then acts under a compulsion. He stands under a necessity, almost like a mere entity of nature. Our philosophy is, therefore, in the highest sense, a philosophy of freedom. It shows first, theoretically, how every force which controls the world from without must fall away in order to make man his own master, in the best of all senses of that word. When man acts morally, this is not from our point of view the fulfillment of duty, but the expression of his wholly free nature. Man acts not because he ought, but because he wills. This point of view Goethe also had in mind when he said, quote, Lessing, who was reluctantly conscious of many sorts of limitations, causes one of his characters to say, No one must. A brilliant and happy man said, He who wills must. A third, to be sure, an educated person added, He who has insight also wills. End quotes. There is no impulse, therefore, for our conduct save our own insight. The free man acts according to his insight, without the intrusion of any sort of compulsion, according to commands which he gives to himself. It is about these truths that the well-known Kant-Schiller controversy revolves. Kant took the standpoint of the commandment of duty. He thought it degrading to the moral law to make it dependent upon human subjectivity. According to his view, man acts morally only when he banishes all subjective motives in his conduct and simply bows to the majesty of duty. Schiller saw in this point of view a degradation of human nature. Must this be so evil that its own impulses must be thus completely set aside if it is to be moral? Schiller and Goethe's world conception can recognize only the point of view we have set forth. The point of departure for human action is to be sought in man himself. For this reason, in history also, the subject of which is man, we must not speak of influences upon man's conduct from without, of ideas which reside in the age, etc. Least of all must we speak of a plan constituting the basis of history. History is nothing but the evolution of human action, points of view, etc. Goethe said, quote, "In all ages, it is only the individuals that have been effectual for science, not the age. It was the age that put Socrates to death with poison, the age that burned Hus. The ages have always remained alike." Unquote. All a priori constructions of plans which are supposed to form the basis of history are contrary to the historical method, as this issues from the nature of history. The goal of history is to learn what men contribute for the advancement of their race, to learn what goal this or that personality has set for himself, what direction he has given to his age. History is to be based entirely on human nature. The will, the tendencies of human nature are to be grasped. Our science of knowledge excludes all possibility that a purpose should be ascribed to history, as if men were educated from a lower stage of perfection to a higher, etc. In the same way, it seems fallacious from our point of view when the effort is made, as Herder does in Ideas for a Philosophy of History of Humanity, to set historical events in due order like facts of nature, according to the succession of cause and effect. The laws of history are of a far higher sort. One fact in physics is so determined by another that the law stands above the phenomenon. A historical fact, as something ideal, is determined by the ideal. Here one can speak of cause and effect only when one depends wholly upon the external. Who could believe that he is in keeping with the facts when he calls Luther the cause of the Reformation? History is a science of ideas. Its reality consists of ideas. Therefore, devotion to the object is the sole correct method. Every step beyond that is unhistorical. Psychology, the science of peoples, and history are the leading forms of spiritual or cultural science. Their methods, as we have seen, are based upon the direct grasp of the ideal reality. Their subject is the idea, the spiritual, as that of inorganic science is the natural law, and that of organics is the type. Chapter 20, Optimism and Pessimism. We have seen that man is the central point of the world order. As spirit, he attains to the highest form of existence, and in thought he achieves the most highly perfected world process. Things really are only as they are illuminated by him. This is a point of view according to which man possesses within himself the basis, the goal, and the central essence of his own existence. It makes man a self-sufficing being. He must find within himself the support for everything that pertains to him, even, therefore, for his happiness. If this is to come to him, he must owe it to himself alone. Any power that bestows it upon him from without condemns him thereby to bondage. Nothing can bestow satisfaction upon a human being except that to which he himself has first given this capacity. If anything is to constitute a happiness for us, we ourselves must first provide the power through which this can occur. Pleasure and displeasure are present for a human being in the higher sense, only in so far as he himself experiences these as such. Hence, all optimism and all pessimism fall to the ground. The former assumes that the world is of such a character that everything in it is good, that it leads man to the highest happiness. But if this is to be true, he himself must first win from the objects in the world something for which he longs. That is, he cannot be happy by means of the world, but only through himself. Pessimism, on the other hand, thinks the ordering of the world is such that it leaves man forever unhappy, that he can never be happy. The objection mentioned above naturally applies also here. The external world is in itself neither good nor evil. It becomes the one or the other only through man. Man would first have to make himself unhappy if pessimism were to have any basis. He would have to bear within him a craving after unhappiness. But the satisfaction of this longing gives a basis for his happiness. Pessimism would have to assume consistently that man sees his happiness in unhappiness. But here such a point of view would end in a nullity. These single objections show clearly enough the fallacy of pessimism. Part G, Conclusion, Chapter 21, Scientific Knowledge and Artistic Creation. Our theory of knowledge has rid cognition of the merely passive character often associated with it, and has conceived it as an activity of the human spirit. It is generally supposed that the content of knowledge is received from without. Indeed, it is supposed that we preserve the objectivity of knowledge in proportion as we refrain from adding anything of our own to the material taken hold of. Our discussion has shown that the true content of knowledge is never the material of which we become aware, but the idea conceived in the mind, which leads us more deeply into the fabric of the world than does any analysis and observation of the external world as mere experience. The idea is the content of knowledge. In contrast with the percept passively received, knowledge is thus the product of the activity of the human mind. We have hereby brought into close proximity cognition and artistic creation, which is also a product of the activity of man. But we have at the same time introduced the necessity of clarifying the mutual relationship of the two. The activity of cognition, as well as that of art, requires that man elevate himself from reality as product to reality as the producing, that he ascend from the created to creation, from chance to necessity. While the outer reality always shows us only the product of creative nature, we elevate ourselves in the spirit to the unity of nature, which now appears to us as that which creates. Every object of reality represents to us one of the innumerable possibilities lying hidden in the creative bosom of nature. Our mind rises to the vision of that fountainhead in which all these potentialities are contained. Science and art are only the objects upon which man stamps what this vision offers to him. In science, this occurs only in the form of the idea, that is, in the directly mental or spiritual medium. In art, it occurs in objects sensibly or mentally perceptible. In science, nature, as, quote, that which includes every single, unquote, appears purely as idea. In art, an object of the external world appears as a representative of the all-inclusive. The infinite, which science seeks in the finite and endeavors to represent in idea, is stamped by art upon a material taken from the world of existence. What appears in science as the idea is in art the image. The same infinite is the object both of science and of art, except that its appearance here is different from its appearance there. The manner of representation is different. Goethe criticized the practice of speaking of the idea of the beautiful as if the beautiful were anything else than the sensible reflection of the idea. Here one sees how the true artist must create out of the fountainhead of all existence, how he stamps upon his works the inevitable, which in science we seek in the form of ideas in nature and in the mind. Science discovers in nature her conformity to law. Art does no less, except that it imprints this upon crude matter. An artistic product is no less a part of nature than is a natural product, except that natural law has been poured into the former as it manifests itself to the human mind. The great works of art that Goethe saw in Italy appeared to him as direct expressions of the inevitable perceived by man in nature. To Goethe, therefore, art also is a manifestation of secret laws of nature. In a work of art, everything depends upon the degree to which an artist has implanted the idea in matter. Not what he handles, but how he handles it is the important point. If in science the substance externally perceived has to be completely submerged so that only its essential nature, the idea, remains, in artistic production this substance must remain except that its peculiarities, its non-essentials, must be completely subdued by the artistic treatment. The object must be lifted completely above the sphere of the accidental and transferred into that of the inevitable. In artistic beauty, nothing must be left upon which the artist has not impressed his own spirit. The what must be surmounted by the how. The surmounting of the sensible by the spirit is the goal of art and of science. The latter surmounts the sensible through resolving it wholly into spirit, the former through implanting the spirit in it. Science sees the idea through the sensible. Art sees the idea in the sensible. A sentence of Goethe's which expresses these truths in a comprehensive way may serve to bring our reflections to a close. Quote, "I think science might be called the knowledge of the general abstract knowledge. Art, on the other hand, would be science applied in an action. Science would be reason and art its mechanism, so that it might also be called practical science. Finally, therefore, science would be the theorem and art the problem." End quote. End of the book by Rudolf Steiner, A Theory of Knowledge Implicit in Goethe's World Conception.